Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast about how to navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. This is the second episode of our Community Questions series. We are talking to engineering leaders around the world to answer the toughest questions from our community. Today, we're going to talk about why many of us are wrong about where our best candidates come from. Every week, we talk to hiring managers who feel confident about a pretty ineffective recruiting channel. We also talk to hiring managers who have little confidence in a channel that's actually their best performing place for great candidates. When we get this right, the benefits are huge. Channels matter. It allows us to have more focused energy, less time on bad calls and interviews, and better fit candidates into the final stage interviews. It also gives us more optionality. We're not stuck with three final interviews, but only one viable candidate. Having choices is great. When we struggle to find out where our best fit candidates come from, we can make poor decisions about where to invest our time. Ultimately, that reduces the probability that we're going to hire the best candidate in our applicant pool. There are a few things that lead hiring managers astray. Number one, it's easy to analyze the current hires to find the best channels. I think that's the most common tactic. The challenge here is this leads to survivorship bias. There's this great example, we'll put the picture in our show notes, of a World War II plane. The project was to analyze the planes that were coming back in the Battle of Britain to figure out what they need to reinforce to make sure planes kept flying and didn't get shut down. The first pass of analysis, they had this really cool graph with all of the planes that came back and all the bullet holes they had in them. And the first pass was, well, let's just reinforce all those areas. The problem was, those were actually the areas of the plane that could get shot without the plane going down. There was survivorship bias. What we actually wanted to do was the inverse of that. The results, if we fall prey to survivorship bias and only analyze our current great hires, we can create homogenous teams. We can undervalue candidates that don't look like us and are less likely to come from the same channels we came from. And we can waste time on the wrong channels and maybe make the wrong hires. Number two, it's easy to compare apples to oranges. If we don't hold referrals to the same standards as job board applicants, our data is probably going to be skewed, for example. We can create a self-fulfilling prophecy where we believe that referrals are better. So we fast-track those folks, give them more benefit of the doubt, and as a result, we bias our sample. When we put referrals through less scrutiny, of course they're going to be better. They're going to be more likely to get hired. This could lead to more referrals. There's nothing wrong with referrals. I'm not picking on referrals here, but we're analyzing channels. We need to compare apples to apples. So let's bring some data to the table. So this difference is made worse because candidate volume can vary quite a bit by channel, orders of magnitude. For example, we analyzed over 2,500 applications through Woven to see what channels produce the highest scoring candidates. And these are the candidates that do real work. Think of a take-home project that's tailored to the specific role. The candidates that score highest are much more likely to get hired. So we've got good correlation between the score. So we look at those 2,500 applications. On average, candidates who come from referrals really do outperform candidates from job boards. Job boards were the lowest mean score. But when we zoomed out and we looked at the top 10% of all candidates based on performance, we found something that was pretty shocking. 87% of top performing applicants came from job boards. So let me say that again. So even though job boards had the lowest average score, if you look at all the top 10%, 87% of the top performers were from job boards. It's kind of crazy. Imagine a curve where one curve is shifted to the left, but there's just so many more samples under that curve, and that's what's going on. So even though referrals were much better on average, job board candidates dominated the top spots. The number of folks that are in our network is always going to be smaller than the number outside. It is a big world and it's only getting bigger. There are lots and lots of job board candidates, especially if we do our job well to place an attractive ad in the right places. Before Woven, many of these job board candidates would have been overlooked because as a hiring manager, we only have so much time. And honestly, reviewing resumes is not most people's idea of a great time, especially when there's just so many low quality resumes in there, folks that are just spraying out the resumes, not really paying attention. And these 2,500 samples were using Woven, but Woven is absolutely not required here. Zapier is a case study for a company that takes the same approach. They have thousands of candidates. They're a remote first company, so anyone in the US can apply. And they're also well known among developers, so they get great candidate volume. Instead of looking at resumes, they use a 10 to 15 minute screener for all their job board candidates. And that allows them to sift through the noise and find the folks that are really good so they can get value out of that large number of job board candidates. A screener, so this think 3 to 5 questions about development, about grit, about the things you really care about. It's as easy to evaluate as a resume, but it contains a lot more information. You can do this with a Google form, type form, any of the tools that we know to capture information. Another challenge when we go to evaluate our candidate channels and we realize that we've treated candidates from different channels differently. So maybe referrals get kind of this fast track and white glove experience. It's easy for us to exacerbate a diversity problem. So referrals specifically are a channel that's probably going to look different than other channels because it's going to be mostly driven by the makeup of your existing team and the folks that are making referrals. We know that diverse teams outperform more homogenous teams. So I don't talk to very many people who don't agree with that and aren't trying to improve diversity, but we're all struggling. One person who has put a lot of thought into this subject is Jason Wong. Jason is an engineering leadership consultant who focuses on diversity and inclusion. His past lives include engineering roles with Yahoo Sports, Etsy, and Blink Health. Here's what he has to say about diversity and inclusion on high growth teams.
Sadly, I think most of the folks I talk to still think of it in terms of a numbers game, right? They're thinking primarily about gender diversity, and they're mostly focused on like the question of how do I hire more women? I think that's, and like the conversation I generally have with folks is like, you need to be focusing on inclusion first and not just diversity.
Can you define that term for us? What's the difference between diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, so Vernon Myers talks about diversity as being asked to the party and inclusion as being asked to dance. And then there's like there's the third stage to that, which is belonging, which is like you're being asked to help plan the party. Really what you want to get to is this further down the stage of inclusion and making sure people can not only just be in the space of the workplace, but also survive, but also thrive and be successful.
So beyond, let's say that a company is excited about diversity. They want to move beyond just gender diversity. You've given a talk about bootstrapping diversity. What are things that companies can do to bootstrap their diversity and inclusion focus?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing in that talk that I want folks to understand is one is that there's no easier time than right now. I think a lot of folks think about when you're starting a company, you have all sorts of business problems. And it's really easy to just sort of defer the diversity and inclusion pieces until later. But so many of the workplace habits and culture are much easier to influence at the start than further down the line. And so, A, you can avoid a ton of work by getting started on this early. B, there's all sorts of data out there that we have right now that shows that actually one of the paths to success is to focus on D&I, right? It has all these sort of profound business impacts. Like diverse teams ship, you know, on average 2 more products a year. They have far more valuable exits. They're far more likely to be profitable. And when I think about my career, you know, I've been in tech for about 20 years. I don't know if I've ever worked on a product or feature that has had the same impact that these studies are showing that D&I can have for a business. So if your business is, you know, one that relies on profitability and making money, this is actually a pretty savvy move to make early on. There are all other sorts of reasons to do this as well, mainly being that it's the right thing to do, but it never hurts to add on all the extras.
Oftentimes, the biggest barriers to building a diverse team are building a representative candidate pool and giving every candidate a fair shot. How do we measure if we've given a fair shot? Rubrics! Recently, we sat down with Christine Spang to learn how she uses rubrics to solve this problem. Christine is the CTO of Nihilus, a cloud infrastructure scale-up that raised a $16 million Series B in August of 2018.
We focused a lot on trying to bring a rigor of standardization to how we evaluate folks. And I think there's always more room for improvement here. And obviously, like, you're never going to get to a point where, like, you're able to, like, objectively evaluate a human being on all axes. But we, especially as we've grown as a team, have more and more actually tried to, like, create rubrics for the questions that we ask of, like, what does a good answer look like? Where's the line between, like, hire and no hire, which I think is really useful and interesting. And there's always going to be cases where you talk to someone and what they say, like, falls completely outside of, like, anything you've thought of before, and you have to, like, make a judgment call as to, like, where that falls.
Rubrics don't have to be perfect to be better than not having a rubric.
Yeah, but it giving you a structured way to think through, like, what are the traits that we're looking for, and what is good and what is not good, I think is really valuable. I also think it's important to just, like, have a culture of talking about biases and, like, what we should correct for and what we shouldn't. So, like, for example, in our hiring wrap-up meetings for after an interview, like, things will come up and, like, someone will say, like, you know, my gut feeling while going through this was X, but after examining that gut feeling a while, I think that I shouldn't pay too much attention to that because there's this bias that can cause that feeling. And I think it's important to be able to have those kinds of conversations.
Rubrics give us the superpower of consistently quantifying fit of a candidate at every single stage, starting at the application. This can both identify drop-offs that cause diversity issues and measure the quality of our sourcing channels. Imagine a world where our first filter is a candidate-friendly exercise that we can judge with rubrics. Instead of saying, we only hired one person from a job board, we could show the score distribution for all channels. Rubrics give us the ability to move from an ordinal ranking system, first, second, third, fourth, yes, no, yes, no, to a cardinal ranking system where we have a score distribution. That score distribution allows us to reason about our candidate pool and that channel. And that's what's enabled by rubrics. Let's take Elon Reshef. Elon is the CTO of Gong.io. They're a conversation intelligence platform for sales that's raised $68 million. He has done a lot of work optimizing his hiring process. Here's what he had to say.
One area we've scaled down on is contingency recruitment. What we found out is that people that look for a job across dozens of companies tend to have, obviously, a low conversion rate and also tend to occupy more of our time on process than we'd like to. So we scaled down on this aspect, and we're focusing on other means, anywhere from incoming lead generation to referrals to outbound reach-outs. A key lesson is to optimize the heck out of the whole recruitment process.
By empirically measuring each decision in our hiring process, we can optimize the system. Otherwise, we're kind of just throwing spaghetti at the wall. One challenge with channels that don't come with a referral is that we really need candidates that are excited about our team and our product. There's a great book called Who, the A Method for Hiring. One of the concepts I really like from that book is called the Skill Will Bullseye. All models are simplifications, but this one I found pretty useful. People need the skills to do the job. They also need the willingness to do the job. Willingness matters. Willingness predicts acceptance rates, which drive costs of our process. And it also predicts who's going to succeed. We're all better at jobs we really want to do. So how do we determine candidate excitement early in the process? We have to be careful here. There are some folks that are just low-key in general, right? Folks on the autism spectrum would be an example. They might be more monotone relatively. One trick I've heard is to ask a question about a hobby. Try to get someone excited about something outside of work. Then ask a question about the job. That allows us to kind of calibrate what does excitement look like for this specific person and see what the difference is. Elon Reshef at Gong.io's method for determining who is excited about their company is also really interesting. Let's hear what Elon has to say.
One of the changes we've made to our recruitment process at Gong is that nowadays we insist on showing each and every candidate relatively early in the process a demo of our product. The Gong product tends to be very impressive. It has consumer-grade look. It has sophisticated machine learning and AI. And we found out that when people see the product, they get excited, and they want to continue the process without at full speed. Whereas before, if we just talked about it and explained what it was, people didn't get the magnitude and the opportunity. And that change alone changed dramatically our conversion rates in the end of the funnel.
As we hire and as we scale, we need to think critically about our sourcing strategy, our portfolio of channels. The best approach produces a diverse and a talented candidate pool. These are a selection of folks that could be a great fit. From there, top hiring managers use rubrics to quantify applications as they advance. That allows us to analyze our channels. Finally, we optimize our process for offer acceptance. We can do that by selling the candidate and also by determining how excited they are, how willing are they to do this job. If we give our candidates a chance to see our product in action, or maybe even the problem we're solving in action, we can hire teammates who have a passion for our product and our mission. Are you in the middle of a big hiring blitz? If so, I want to hear from you. Where are you finding your best candidates? Do you think you're seeing any candidate pool skew caused by your process? Send me an email at wes@woventeams.com. I love thinking about this. I read every email personally. I'd love to hear from you. That's wes@woventeams.com. Next week, we're uncovering the tricks that top hiring managers use to find great fit candidates that usually go overlooked. Think Moneyball. Until then, keep on scaling.